Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Republic Tobacco v. North Atlantic Trading. Mr. Bergen.
May it please the Court, my name is Charles Bergen, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, plaintiff below, Republic Tobacco. In this case, we have an extraordinary award of fees by the trial court. $1,091,054 was awarded in fees. Of that, $940,000 related to post-trial proceedings, due at least in large part to a finder's fee that was paid to a shareholder or bondholder that found financing for that. Only $150,000 of the total that was sought and awarded in the trial court was for a supersedeas bond, which is the only bond that the trial court was even authorized to address. Let me make very clear the distinction. It goes back to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and obtaining a stay. Under Rule 62B, there is a stay. One can obtain a stay during the pendency of new trial motions, motions to vacate the judgment, motions for judgment, NOV. 62B says, in its discretion and on such conditions for the security of the adverse party as are proper, the court, and that's the trial court, may stay the execution of any proceedings. That's the $940,000 pre-appeal costs that North Atlantic seeks to have this court affirm. The $150,000 is attributable to supersedeas bond, and that falls under 62D, stay upon appeal. And there it says, when an appeal is taken, the appellant, by giving a supersedeas bond, may obtain a stay subject to the exceptions contained in the subdivision A of this rule. The bond may be given at or after the time of filing the notice of appeal or of procuring the order allowing the appeal, as the case may be. So we look at the pre-appeal costs under one standard, the post-appeal costs under the other. Most of the money is in pre-appeal costs and should be judged under Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 54D, which governs awards of costs by the trial court. I would first say that the easy way to address this is to say that this court, in its order, referring costs back to the district court under Appellate Rule 39E3, dealt only with supersedeas bond. That's all it discussed. And supersedeas bond is clearly defined in Rule 62D, as something that's filed at or after the time of the filing of appeal. What North Atlantic sought and what they obtained in the trial court was costs from before then, from prior to the filing of the appeal. Costs incurred in July of 2003 when the appeal was not filed until January of 2004. The key issues on a district court finding under 54D are different than under the appellate rules 39. Under 54D, first of all, the party to obtain costs in the trial court must be the prevailing party. In this case, Republic defeated all 10 of North Atlantic's claims from the Louisville case, which became counterclaims in this case.
But here we have a situation where North Atlantic prevailed on its arguments to reduce the amount of the bond.
North Atlantic did not prevail on its arguments to reduce the amount of the bond. It prevailed on its argument in the trial court to reduce the judgment from $18 million to $7.4 million in the trial court. And it was successful on that. It never sought costs there as a prevailing party. It never sought costs there saying we've won something. And indeed, if you look at the definition of prevailing party under the Heinold case, this court is very clear. Prevailing party means a party who has obtained some relief in an action, even if that party has not sustained all of his or her claims. There was no relief in an action. They didn't bring any claims that they prevailed on, and they didn't bring any defenses that they prevailed on. Instead, they lost on the defenses, and the only thing that this court did was say, look, and we didn't ask the jury for some certain. We say this in our papers, but we told the jury we want a fair number. That's what we said, and that's in the record. Jury came back with the $18.2 million. We said it wasn't liquidated. Judge Grady, who heard the testimony, saw the witnesses and evaluated it, remitted it to 7.4. Again, he had an opportunity to see it, and he said, I understand it's not a certain thing. And this court, frankly, said, look, We're not sure what the right number is, but the last number that was the highest number awarded was $3 million, so we're going to give you a tie with that. I said to Mr. Landau, you know, how many champagne corks did you pop when we won the $3 million? Probably not very many. This was a record judgment, and it involved not only the defeat of their defenses, but declaratory relief that exonerated our programs, which was the central focus of the litigation. They achieved none of the goals they set out to achieve when they filed their complaint. They prevailed on none of the defenses when they filed their answer. All they did was convince this court and Judge Grady that the jury had set a fair number higher than was appropriate. Furthermore, in the district court, the prevailing party is judged, again, by the entire action. And where a party has prevailed, they cannot be taxed with the opponent's costs. The non-prevailing party doesn't recover costs. That's in Perlman versus Zell. It's in Worsham versus United States. It's in 370 Leasing versus Ampex, which is particularly interesting, Judge Williams, because in that case, there were only nominal damages awarded. And the court in that case said, the Fifth Circuit said, in our view, the award of nominal damages marks the plaintiff, 370, as the prevailing party within the meaning of Rule 54D. So even if we had won the $10 nominal damages, which is what North Atlantic said we were entitled to throughout this case, we still would have been the prevailing party. $3 million, admittedly, we talked about more, but as they said in the Maltese Falcon, you know, you can talk about big numbers, but this is coin of the realm. We won $3 million in coin of the realm. The other reasons why they don't receive the damages in the trial court are, first of all, it was untimely. Second, they never claimed it when they got the reduction from $18 million to $7 million. Third, the case law says they can't shift it to the prevailing party. And fourth, the list of costs in the trial court is restricted under Crawford Fittings and its progeny to those set forth in Section 1920 of 28 U.S. Code. So, and for all those reasons, they're not entitled to the $940,000. Let me turn to the $150,000 in appellate costs as well. Under Rule 39A4, this court decided that each party should bear its own costs on appeal. This court said, at least for those costs that were taxed in this court, that each party should bear its own costs. North Atlantic moved to amend the mandate so that it could pursue costs in the trial court as well. But I believe, and there is no case law that supports the position, that the trial court, while it's free to assess the amount of costs, also has the freedom to determine who is the prevailing party here and who was not. The three of you sat as a panel. You heard the appellate arguments, you evaluated the appellate arguments, and you decided, after hearing those arguments, that we should each bear our own costs for that appeal. And that seems to be the rule under 39E3, you decide that. There are no cases where a party has prevailed or had costs split under 39E3, and then the court has said, but the district court can effectively underrule us and award a huge magnitude of costs differently based on its reading of what we have done here. Key cases here, the Golden Door Jewelry versus Lloyd's Underwriter case, where the court says, where this court, the Court of Appeals order, explicitly fails to grant a class of costs, we must input that silence as a rejection of those costs. We also cite the In Re Sue securities test. That's a Fifth Circuit case. So this party held we should each bear our own costs. I don't think the district court can ignore this court's ruling. Under Corder versus Lucent, this court, which is a case that was cited by my opponents, this court said, we review the district court's award of costs for abuse of discretion, reviewing carefully the statutory authority for recovering a cost, but deferring to the district court's determination of whether a recoverable expense is reasonable. And the question here is, what statutory authority did Judge Grady have for effectively overturning the ruling of this panel that each party should bear its own costs on appeal? There is none, and there is none cited. Can the district court make a different determination, even in the absence of a directive from the appellate court, which is the case here? Most of the appellate courts look at a variant, I suppose, of the prevailing party test under 54D. We cite JTH Tax, which says a reading of Rule 39A clearly indicates that the taxing of costs on appeal is made in consideration of the success of the parties to the appeal relative to each other. Again, after the appeal, we were exonerated on antitrust grounds. Our declaratory judgment stood up. We jumped through 10 different hoops to maintain a liability judgment of $1 million, the largest such judgment that's ever been awarded, and we received punitive damages as well. This is not a technical violation. We established these damages before the jury, before Judge Grady on motion for a new trial, and before this court. The fact that we won the game 3-0 instead of 18-0 doesn't mean we didn't win. Now, this court decided we would all bear our own costs here. We can accept that. But what we can't accept is Judge Grady looking at this court's opinion and reaching an entirely different conclusion.
Mr. Bergen, is it your position that because the only victory as you see it, or if you wouldn't maybe not call it a victory, the damage reduction takes this factually away from Bull Moose?
Yeah, I think it does. And
I mean, I understand Bull Moose had a different breakout as to win-loss, so to speak.
Right. And Bull Moose...
Simply because it's damages, that's not sufficient to bring it under Bull Moose?
Correct. Judge Grady ignored the key language in Bull Moose, which is where the court said the company would not have had to pay for a super sedeus bond in the first instance but for the plaintiff's pursuit of their claims under the wrong legal theory. In Bull Moose, there was a complete victory in the Court of Appeals. That claim was dismissed. It was over. Later, the plaintiffs came up with an entirely different claim that they were allowed to plead and prove in the second trial. But as to success, yeah, the company in Bull Moose was successful in establishing that there was no claim, and they defeated that claim. The fact that they later lost on another newly pled claim distinguishes that case from this one, where the claims remained intact. We prevailed on liability. The only question was, in a somewhat gray area, what was the appropriate amount of damages?
So there has to be a liability component, is your view?
Indeed, because it talks about prevailing on claims and or prevailing on defenses. North Atlantic prevailed on neither. They simply got this court to agree that the evidence supported only a smaller verdict or a smaller judgment than the one that was there. I'm now into my rebuttal. I'd be happy to take questions or else I'll reserve time.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bergen. Mr. Landau.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This appeal turns on a simple point. Someone has to bear the cost of the excessive security over $3 million in this case. And it's either got to be Republic, which insisted on security in the full amount of the original judgment of $18.6 million, or NATC, which offered to post a $3 million security but was rebuffed. The district court decided that it was more equitable for Republic to bear this cost, and that decision is not remotely an abuse of discretion. Republic was certainly entitled to insist on security in the full amount of the judgment, but Republic must now bear the consequences of that choice. It was clear from the outset, as the district court recognized, that the $18.6 million jury verdict in this case stood on shaky legal ground, and Republic is now reaping what it sowed back in the summer of 2003 by sticking it to us, as they were entitled to do, but making us get security in the full amount of the judgment. Republic's main argument, as we just heard this morning, is that it, and only it, is the prevailing party in this case, so that NATC is not entitled to recover any costs.
So is it your view that you were a prevailing party on the defamation claim?
It's our view, that, Your Honor, that we were the prevailing party in the post-trial motions in substantially reducing the judgment, first by 60% and then again by more than 50% in this court. And I think what really separates us is that our position is, and the case law supports this, that there can be multiple prevailing parties. Rule 54, by its terms, does not say the prevailing party in the action. It just says the prevailing party. And we are the prevailing party. I think this goes to your point before, Judge Williams, that it's hard to say that we were not it's hard to explain how we were not prevailing in some sense when we reduced the judgment by 85% from the time of the original judgment to where it ultimately wound up. It started out at $18.6 million, and it wound up at $3 million. And so if you go back to Mr. Bergen's cork-popping test, I hardly think that Republic was popping corks saying, guess what, we did great, we won, we just got this reduced from $18.6 to $3 million. So, again, let's just remember where we stood. At the time of the original judgment, we had an $18.6 million judgment against us. It was by far the largest jury verdict in the history of Illinois defamation law. At that point, in order to challenge that judgment, we had to get security. We were in a box. We couldn't proceed to challenge that judgment without posting a bond. We asked the district court. We had no fewer than four hearings in the immediate weeks following the judgment to discuss the security issue. We said, please let us post some lesser amount. It will put us into bankruptcy to be forced to post a bond in the full amount of the judgment, because no ordinary bonding company will give us a bond because we don't have unencumbered assets. The other side insisted on security in that full amount, and so ultimately we had to go out and get a loan from the only party that was willing to give us a loan on realistic commercial terms, which happened to be an investor in our company, which, again, they try and make this into something nefarious, but it's understandable that this is a person who had a lot to lose if the company went into bankruptcy. So, of course, they were more willing than others to make sure that we got that financing that we needed. So at that point, we were in that box. We managed, by the skin of our teeth, to live to fight another day. We posted the security. We brought the post-trial motions as a result of having posted that security. We filed the appeal, and we prevailed in the sense that we got the judgment slashed from $18.6 million to $3 million. And I think Mr. Bergen just responded to Judge Flom's question by saying, by trying to distinguish the Bull Moose case on the ground that there was a liability determination there. But nothing in the rule, nothing in Rule 39 or in Rule 54 says prevailing limits it in that way. That's an artificial limitation that they're putting in. And I think this is classically a determination that's within the sound discretion of the district court. Judge Grady heard the arguments. This court sent this issue back to Judge Grady after we moved in this court out of an abundance of caution in light of the 11th Circuit's decision in Golden Door, which suggested that you had to bring this to the appellate court's attention. We did so. This court said under this circuit's precedent that should be brought in the district court in the first instance. But this court's order sending the issue back to the district court has to be understood as modifying the court's original judgment that said each party to bear its own costs, because obviously this court did not send us back to request costs in the district court in the first instance, if that would have been a fool's errand, because this court had already precluded costs. So I think that argument really doesn't fly.
I think, could you just elaborate a little further on your argument regarding Section 1920, and also, you know, what the Supreme Court has said in Crawford, you know, that 1920 specifically lists the expenses that the federal court can tax.
Absolutely.
As a cost, and aren't we required to obey that directive? And certainly appeal-related costs are not in that list.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And let me answer that on two dimensions. The first is procedural, and the second is substantive. With respect to procedure, they never raised this argument in the district court that these costs were not authorized by 1920. In fact, they concede that in their brief here.
Right, but this is a purely a legal issue, and can't we deal with that on appeal?
Well, Your Honor, we raised purely...
We're not procedurally barred from dealing with that.
Fair enough, but even legal issues, Your Honor, can't be raised for the first time on appeal, or should not ordinarily be raised for the first time on appeal, as we learned to our chagrin at the merits phase of this case, where if you go back and look at this court's opinion on the merits in this very case, it very clearly states that the general rule is that you cannot raise arguments on appeal, and for the first time, that you did not present to the district court. And I would say that's particularly true here, where this argument is really very far-reaching. I mean, the costs of supersedious bonds have been an element of costs going back decades. I mean, if you look back at the Northern Indiana oil case from, I think, 1951 in this circuit, this is a venerable component of cost that's been awarded at common law by courts traditionally. The Crawford, they read the Crawford case very broadly as establishing a bright-line rule that if it isn't in 1920, it isn't in Rule 54D. This court rejected that interpretation of the Crawford case in the Commercial Credit Equipment Company case, which is at 920 F. 2nd at page 1368, note 10. And what this court said is, we disagree with the description of the Supreme Court's holding in Crawford that a court may only tax those costs specifically authorized by a statute. Rather, in Crawford, the Supreme Court merely stated that a general rule, such as Rule 54D, cannot overcome a specific limitation, such as the 28 U.S.C. Section 1821 witness fee. In other words, in the Crawford case, Your Honor, the district court in that case, under Rule 54, purported to grant more than $30 a day for witness fees. There was a specific statute on point that said the capped witness fees at $30 a day. And I think what this court recognized in the commercial credit case is that you shouldn't read Crawford for standing for anything broader than that proposition, that you can't give award costs that are specifically precluded by statute. To read Crawford, Your Honor, to preclude any award of costs, no matter how venerable at common law, such as the cost of a supersedious bond, would be a real extension of that case. And again, I think this court recognized that in the commercial credit. There is some language in Crawford, as we have to admit, Your Honor, the language that Your Honor referred to before is in Crawford. But we think that language is just a dicta that's been picked up in other dicta. And when you look at the, again, if you think about the rather revolutionary consequences of that, there's no indication that the Supreme Court considered whether or not the 1920 would preclude even traditional costs that have been awarded at common law, such as the cost of a supersedious bond. And one important point, that interpretation of the rule would knock out not only this local rule from the Northern District of Illinois and similar local rules from the District of Columbia all the way out to the Central District of California, but it would also knock out Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 39, which also finds its source of statutory authority in Section 1920, and which specifically contemplates the costs of supersedious bonds as an element of costs. So certainly the Congress that is at least implicitly allowing these rules to go into effect by kind of negative veto should not be lightly assumed to be endorsing rules that would be inconsistent with other statutes.
Isn't a big distinction in 39E that the costs are not contingent on prevailing party status?
Well, Your Honor,
and it's one of relative success on appeal?
That's true, Your Honor, but as I understand their Crawford fitting / Section 1920 argument, it's that Section 1920 only authorizes those costs that are that a party can recover only those costs that are specifically authorized in Section 1920. If that's true, that's equally as true for FRAP 39 as it is for the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54, both of which find the source of their statutory authority in Section 1920.
So 39E was passed after 1920.
Well, Your Honor, again, I think that's a fair point, but again, there have been...
There's any conflict with 1920. Language of 39E would seem to trump that, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't think you could ever say that a rule could trump a statute, Your Honor. I think ultimately...
Both passed by Congress, right?
Well, the rule is not really passed by Congress in the sense, Congress can veto a rule, essentially. But I think you should certainly try to harmonize them, Your Honor. I mean, I suppose if there were an absolute stark dichotomy, if one said X and one said not X, then you'd have no choice. But we don't think that's the situation here, unless, in our view, you substantially overread the Crawford fitting case. Again, we would propose, Your Honor, we would say that you shouldn't even reach this rather far-reaching issue. I mean, this cost dispute becomes a pretty sweeping case, far more significant, kind of ironically, than the underlying merits dispute if this court were to basically announce an interpretation that would knock out these local rules all across the country and as well as FRAP 39E, we would submit. So, I think that's a very you know, that is something this court should certainly not lightly do, and that's, this is not a case, in other words, where you should excuse the waiver by failing to reach that. One point that Mr. Bergen really harped on a lot is he is trying to put as much as he can into the district court component of this, and he puts the fixed fee of $595 solely and exclusively into the basket of a post-trial cost. That is really not a fair thing at all, because basically that is a fee that we had to incur to raise any challenge to the judgment. We incurred that, and you can look at page A14 of the supplemental, A13 of the supplemental appendix, and the joint appendix 161. We had to incur that fee to raise any challenge whatsoever, be that an appeal or a post-trial challenge to the judgment, and that was a fixed one-time fee. And so that fee can be sustained as either an appellate cost or a district court cost. It's not, there aren't two separate bonds. We went out and got one bond to pursue the appeal. We also filed a post-trial motion. And if you look even at the terms and conditions of the bond, which are attached to the Brunson Declaration below, it makes clear that this was understood to be for the purpose of appellate costs, so for the purpose of security to pursue the appeal. And again, it's SUPAP A13, that was understood by both parties to be a fee that would be the appellate security fee. In other words, there aren't two different bonds you go out and get, and I think they must feel that the appellate is more of an uphill battle, so they're trying so hard to shoehorn that $595 into the district court, but that's really creating an artificial dichotomy. On the prevailing party issue, I would say, again, they try to say kind of a black and white basis, there can only be one prevailing party in an action. And we would say that this court's decision in First Commodity recognizes, as many other decisions from this and other circuits do, that courts have discretion to apportion costs where there are multiple prevailing parties. A lot of times in litigation, it's not a black and white thing. Now, it may have to be black and white if people are coming in and saying, we are the prevailing party. We want all of our costs on a global basis. And certainly there are cases in this court that say, yeah, well, when people are trying to get all their costs globally, then you've got to decide who is the prevailing party. But here, we are only seeking the costs that are directly attributable to our success on appeal, or on our success in the post-trial motions and then on appeal, which is the cost of the bond, the security, that we were forced to post in order to pursue those challenges. In other words, we're not globally seeking all of our costs in the litigation. We're only asking for a very targeted cost, which was the cost of the security that we were forced to post, even to have our day in court to make these arguments in the first place, which led ultimately to this court saying, as a matter of law, that the judgment was invalid and illegal to the extent that it awarded more than $3 million in damages. I see my light is on. There are no further questions.
Thank you, Shalanda. Mr. Bergen?
Can you begin with this allocation of the $595,000? Why doesn't it make more sense to allocate that fee over both the pre-appeal and appeal time periods, as counsel argued?
A couple of reasons. One, because that was paid in July. It was paid before it received any consent from us. It was paid before the court had approved it. They actually told the court when it was a fait accompli. It was not paid at or after the time of the appeal, which is the test under Civil Procedure Rule 62D for a supersedeas bond. Moreover, and this is a kind of a related issue, and I want to address your question, let me not get off on it. They're entitled to a reasonable supersedeas bond. The case law holds that both the Fletcher and then the following cases. The question is, do we look at an objective standard of reasonableness? Every other case talks about 1% being typical, 1% being normal. Theirs, this bond was, of the $7.44 million judgment, this was, what, 15% of that. So, first, there's a question of timing. Second, If you don't have what is an objectively reasonable bond, using a 1% figure or something like that, then you get into fact-finding. This is $1 million. While we had something like 40 depositions in the main case, we had no depositions concerning this. Judge Grady gave us no discovery. We don't know who the Cayman Island entities are that were paid. We don't know who the investor was. And be sure of this. The investor didn't actually make the loan. The investor got a finder's fee. So the question is, it's a lot of smoke. It's a lot of uncertainty. They are claiming reasonableness of this fee, which they call, in their own papers, excessive, unusual, and extreme, that fee, we should somehow take their word for it.
Well, did you challenge that amount in the trial?
Yeah. Sure.
And ask for discovery on it?
Ask for discovery. We wanted to know who got it. We asked for papers. Judge Grady denied that.
That's my understanding. And Judge Grady's response was what?
His response was essentially that because we had wanted to bond the $18 million,
right,
we would pay for the whole thing. Judge Grady, in doing that, ignored Rule 54D about a prevailing party. We were the party that had to pay huge amount of money to bring the case, to fight off their defenses and their claims. And think about the rule Judge Grady would have created. If you accept this rule, every reduction in a judgment on appeal puts the prevailing party at risk, not just for the increment, not just for the difference between the 7.44 and the 3 million, but for all of the loser's costs. And if the trials court opinion is allowed to stand, a victorious appellee must take the risk that an insecure, inefficient, or high-risk appellant can impose unreasonable costs far in excess of the 1% that's normal. In this case, I'll leave you with this. It's a factual determination, so we haven't focused on the facts. But between July, when they paid the money for the bond, and February, when the supersedeas bond was actually filed, they bought a company for $22 million in cash within 3 days of the reduction of the judgment in November. They paid $8 million to improve their factory in December. That's in the press. Their 10-K statement for the year showed that they had $8.7 million in free cash. And Judge Grady ignored all that. Now, he's entitled to do that, but he still has limits on his discretion. And finally, in February, at the time that they were claiming that they needed to do this, they refinanced the entire company for $350 million and paid themselves bonuses. This was not an eggshell skull plaintiff. This was somebody who played a game with the court, the trial court, got away with it, and it should end here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bergen. Thank you, Mr. Landau. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.